counselors from Northern Ireland has traveled to London to meet with the families of jailed Palestine Action hunger strikers in a show of solidarity. The development comes on a day that saw several protests in support of pro-Palestine activists currently held in British prisons.
Members of Derry City Strabane District Council, and our council does have a history of solidarity and support for the Palestinian cause, and that was extended to support the hunger strikers and express solidarity. We listened to the families, and what they were saying is very, very similar to what Irish people faced at the same enemy, the British imperialism, with the hunger strikes in 80 and 81, and not just that very system that demonizes and criminalizes anybody who dares, you know, oppose it.
It's no surprise to us that the British state, with all its Zionist interests, with all its colonial interests, with all the violence that it spreads around the world, continues to ignore us. The lives of the hunger strikers, just like the lives of the Palestinian people, are worth nothing compared to the profit of companies like Elbit Systems. So we make our own justice. That's why we're here today with our comrades from Ireland. That's why we continue to fight on the streets with the people to do things in our own way.
I think it's appalling. You know, there's a genocide going on. The ceasefire is only in name. Israel's killed maybe 400 people since the so-called ceasefire happened. I completely support the hunger strikers. I think it's amazing what they're doing. I completely support the people in prison. I support Palestine Action, taking action against the weapons companies that send munitions off to Gaza and the West Bank to murder people.
Your Honor, strongly condemn the continuation of Israel's genocide in Gaza through the regime's incessant bombardment and blockade of humanitarian aid. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said that the international community, taught by the UN, United Nations, that is responsible for taking immediate and effective measures to stop Israel's crimes and hold perpetrators to account. He categorically condemned Israel's blatant violations of international humanitarian law and the regime's war crimes and crimes against humanity, stressing the need to end its impunity. Baghaei said that U.S. and other countries providing Israel with arms and political support are complicit in the regime's crimes in occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. And he added that despite its ceasefire agreements with Gaza and Lebanon, Israel continues to commit savage crimes against both nations due to Washington's unbridled support and inaction of ceasefire guarantors. Baghaei called for serious measures to confront Israel's threats to regional and international peace and security. Iran has called for next Secretary General of the United Nations to be selected through a transparent process, voicing readiness to engage in meaningful discussions throughout the process. Iran's permanent UN ambassador, Amir Said Iravani, made the comment while addressing a Security Council session held to discuss the qualities of the future of the UN chief. He said a candidate who has deliberately failed to uphold the UN Charter or to condemn unlawful military attacks against peaceful nuclear facilities despite responsibilities of the organ that he leads could not be trusted as a faithful guardian of the UN Charter. Iravani added that such a person will not be able to fulfill his duties independently, impartially, and without political bias or fear of powerful states as required under the Charter. Iran's ambassador also declared Tehran's willingness to work with the next Secretary General to advance peace, justice, and purposes and principles of the UN Charter. Meanwhile, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi is on a two-leg official visit to Belarus and Russia. In Minsk, he met with senior officials and signed several agreements aimed at deepening bilateral cooperation. Maryam Azarche reports.
What good can ever come from American sanctions? Part of the answer now unfolding during Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi's three-day official visit to Belarus and Russia, a trip that underscores growing ties among countries facing similar pressure. The dynamic on display in Minsk, where Araghchi held high-level talks with senior Belarusian officials. The two sides signed agreements aimed at expanding cooperation and further strengthening already close ties. Officials from both countries say mounting external pressure has accelerated coordination across political and economic fronts.
On political issues, our positions in international organizations and various forums are very close to one another. resisting unilateralism and coercive measures, as well as policies of force and domination, has been one of our shared efforts. Together with a number of other countries that share this stance against American unilateralism, we have formed the Friends of the Charter Group at the UN. We have decided to increase consultations within the framework of this group and likewise our cooperation within BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the Eurasian Union will be further expanded.
Together we have explored and developed very interesting frameworks for a political approach. Ahead of us are new decisions and corresponding projects. We are confident that as a result of today's agenda review, we will be able to reach deeper and more substantive conclusions and strengthen international relations and ties between peoples.
Abbas Araghchi expressed gratitude that Belarus had demonstrated solidarity with Iran during the 12-day U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country. However, the talks were not limited to political stances and international affairs.
Our economic cooperation is extensive and spans across multiple sectors. However, it's insufficient, and both sides are committed to expanding collaboration in trade, investment, and joint production. For example, Iran is a major customer of Belarus's potash, and it was decided today to further facilitate this cooperation.
As part of his visit, Araghchi paid homage to the Belarusian victims of World War II at Minsk Victory Square, a gesture highlighting shared experiences of hardship, now echoed in what both countries describe as an ongoing economic war driven by sanctions.
These meetings are seen as yet another step in strengthening friendly ties, with Iran's top diplomat pushing forward cooperation in various political, economic, and regional fronts. Mariam Azatcher, Minsk.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia supports Iran's right to have a peaceful nuclear energy. In an interview with the IRIB, Lavrov referred to Bushehr nuclear power plant that's being constructed in southwestern Iran as an example of cooperation between the two. He added that both Moscow and Tehran are determined to expand relations. Lavrov also slammed the European Troika for reinstating sanctions against Tehran, calling it a disgrace of diplomacy. Lavrov noted there is no solid document showing Iran has violated obligations under the rules of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And regarding the 12-day imposed war back in June, the Russian foreign minister said that Moscow has condemned the illegitimate attacks launched by Israel and the U.S. against Iran. And now we turn over to the Russia-Ukraine war with two sides, a trend of fresh fire across multiple areas, including the Black Sea region. Ukrainian officials say in the country's Sumy region, a 62-year-old man was killed in a Russian drone strike. Russian forces also launched hundreds of attacks in Zaporizhia, injuring over a dozen people and damaging homes. Some other areas in Ukraine, including Kherson, saw fresh Russian attacks as well. Meanwhile, Moscow says it's destroyed scores of Ukrainian drones overnight. Amid exchanges of fire, diplomatic efforts continue. Both sides weigh conditions for a settlement to the conflict. Kremlin said Monday that Ukraine must not join the NATO military alliance.
Naturally, the possible Ukraine's membership in NATO is one of the cornerstones and, of course, it is subject to special discussion. And this is the sense of a negotiation process that I repeated once again.
Peskov also said Russia expects an update from Washington following U.S. talks with European countries and Ukraine in Berlin. After a meeting in the German capital, Trump said an agreement to end the war is closer than ever. Moscow argues that Ukraine should give up joining NATO. It also says Kiev must surrender territory for the war to end. European leaders, meanwhile, say any territorial concession can only be decided by Ukraine itself and that firm security guarantees are needed. In the UK, the unemployment rate has increased to 5.1%, marking the highest in 4 years. That, according to figures from the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, which shows a jobless rate in 3 months to October. The ONS says the overall picture signals a weakening labor market, reflecting, quote, subdued hiring activity. The numbers also indicate youngsters are bearing the brunt of job cuts as a fall in payroll numbers and increase in unemployment were particularly among younger age groups. A Muslim man who bravely disarmed an assailant during Sunday's violent attack at a Jewish event in Sydney is now held as a hero among the Australian public. Let's listen to a number of Sydney residents sharing their admiration for this Muslim man.
I was actually proud. When I saw it, I thought to myself, is that Ahmed, because I know him, and I looked at it twice and I thought, realised it was him, and I thought, good on you, you know what I mean? So when you know the person, it's extra special, so what he did was unbelievable. Oh, we used to see each other. He owned the shop next door, and we'd run into each other nearly every day. Just a normal bloke running his shop. I'm a normal bloke working in a shop, and it was just the day-to-day interaction.
Oh, look, I think it shows just the strength of people in the area. We've got somebody who I've walked past for years and years and years, and to find out that he is the Bondi hero, I think is absolutely astonishing. We saw a little bit of stuff in the media saying he was actually down at the, he was one of the greengrocers at the fruit shop. But it turns out he's the local tobacconist. You know, he owns a local sort of convenience store. It was incredibly astonishing. But I think it's just, he's a role model for us all, and it really encompasses the Aussie spirit. And I'm incredibly proud to live in the area, and I think everybody is. It just blows me away. Absolutely blows me away.
U.S. President Donald Trump has sued the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, over editing parts of a speech that he made around 5 years ago. Trump filed a lawsuit in federal court in Miami. The lawsuit says the BBC maliciously strung together two comments he made in order to show that he had encouraged his supporters to engage in violence during the Capitol Hill attack back in January of 2021. The complaint seeks $5 billion in damages, alleging that a British public broadcaster defamed him by his speech edit. The BBC previously admitted editing gave a mistaken impression that Trump made a direct call for violent action, but it said that there is no legal basis to sue. U.S. military says it's launched fresh strikes on alleged drug trafficking vessels in international waters. U.S. Southern Command says three vessels were struck while they were transiting along routes in the East Pacific. It added the attacks killed 8 men. Since September, Washington has targeted now at least 26 boats in the Caribbean and East Pacific under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. The attacks come amid escalating tensions with Venezuela over U.S. accusations that it is aiding drug smugglers. President Donald Trump has even threatened a ground invasion of the Latin American country. Crockett says campaign is actually aimed at toppling the Venezuelan government and seizing the country's natural oil resources. Meanwhile, French protesters have gathered in the capital of Paris to denounce austerity measures and a growing war economy. They argue that public funds are diverted from healthcare and education to militarization and foreign interventions. Demonstrators also criticize France's recent military actions abroad and billions allocated to the defense budget. Students in particular voice concerns over university's partnership with arms companies, saying makes them complicit in genocide. Our correspondent has spoken to some of the participants.
This gathering follows other demonstrations and rallies that we have organized against militarization and war, because, as you must know, in France and throughout the European Union, the economy is doing poorly. But it is being redirected toward war and toward imperialist aggression budgets, whether it is support for Israel, the war in Ukraine, or interventions in Africa. France, just last week, carried out a military intervention in Benin. That is just one example among others. So we have a system that is completely running out of steam and is trying to survive through a war economy and by increasing arms sales, profits, arms dealers, and so on. And of course, young people in particular, but also the country more generally, do not want to sacrifice healthcare budgets, education budgets, and more broadly their standard of living to a war policy and to sending young people to serve as cannon fodder.
So this is a rally against austerity and the war budget. We are here to denounce the social security budget, but also to denounce the war budget, which I believe is close to 400 billion euros for imperialist war, for colonial wars in Palestine and everywhere else in the world. I think that when you are a student, you realize this more than other people do. For example, our universities are directly complicit in these genocides. If we take the case of Palestine, I am a student at Sorbonne University, and Sorbonne University has direct partnerships with arms companies.
And staying with France, farmers have blocked roads in southern parts of the country in protest at the government's animal health policy. The protesters were angry with the government's measures aimed at curbing an outbreak of lumpy skin disease among livestock. Measures include culling of entire cattle herds. Police intervened to disperse crowds as veterinary teams arrived to carry out the culling. On Friday, more than 200 cows were slaughtered in a village near the Spanish border after a single case of the disease was detected. Farmers' unions say the wiping out entire herds is unnecessary and ineffective and are calling for nationwide blockades across France to put an end to the madness, as they put it. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program. Today is a special.
Can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue, planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun, such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves, isn't this proof enough for us?
Today's Tuesday. It's the 25th of Jamadi al-Thani 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar. This is corresponding to the 25th of Azar 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar and the 16th of December 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. What a beautiful coincidence, 25th of Jamadi al-Thani and 25th of Azar. Five more days are to the end of autumn season in Islamic Republic of Iran and the start of winter. And the first month of winter in Iran is called the month of day. As usual, as regular, let's bless our day with the beautiful fragrance, with the beautiful taste of the verses of the Holy Quran for today, Surah Al-Isra, Ayah 24. Let's listen and then we'll continue our discussion. Do not go anywhere. Stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Wa qada rabbuka alla ta'budu illa iyyahu wa bil walidayni ihsana. Imma yablughanna 'indaka al-kibra
And your Lord has decreed that you not worship except him, and to parents good treatment, whether one or both of them reach old age while with you. Say not to them so much as, uff, and do not repel them, but speak to them a noble word.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Welcome back. What you listened to was Surah Al-Isra, Ayah 24. Thanks for tuning in with the program today, special on IRIB English Radio with me, Atta, the host of this program. In words and in deeds, try your best to be humble towards your parents. That's it. That's the tip for today. And that's the headline for today. By the phrase, lure unto them the wing of humility, which is literally mentioned in this ayah, it is the simile which refers to making oneself in the utmost sense of submissive gentleness towards one's parents. It makes one recall a bird which opens us its wings to provide shelter for its offspring. Never gaze straight into the eyes of your parents. Never talk to them directly. Always gaze down your head. Always put your head down. Always try to confirm them. Always try to respect them. Never try to say a murmuring bad sound. Oh, oh, ah, ah, ooh, ee, sigh. Oh, I am tired today, Dad. Leave me. Oh, Mom, come on. Oh, Mom. Do not say such words. Never, ever. These are your parents. You have to respect them according to Islamic laws and Islamic teachings. The Almighty Allah thus proclaims to cover your parents gently under your love and generosity by providing them with shelter and care as they provided you with shelter and care when you were little. Now, what's the sad news? The sad news is that today, the people, the children, listen to me, they take their old parents to the old houses. They take their parents to the elderly houses. They take their parents to rehabilitation centers. This is absolutely wrong. They leave them. They say that, okay, they will be over there with their old friends, having a good life, having good atmosphere over there, a nurse to feed them. No, no, no. Nothing will replace the love of the children for the old parents. Do not do that. Please do not do that. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not favor such actions.
Every morning I wake up and see the splendor of Allah's beauty. The sky at dawn, the silent trees. Praise be to Him, supreme is He. Praise be to Him, supreme is He. As I set to start my day, I think of Allah and I pray. His blessings are with me always. Praise be to Him, most kind is He. Praise be to Him, most kind is He.
Motherhood more than a job. A Muslim mother has a valued and dignified role. Her unparalleled gifts to the child have been aptly described by Imam Zain al-Abidin in Risalat al-Huquq, the Chapter of Rights. For your information, I would like to say that Risalat al-Huquq, or Treatise of Rights, is a book, of course a compilation, compiled by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam on different rights which are on shoulder regarding our environment, the animals around, neighbors, colleagues, friends, parents, teachers, pupils, children, everybody. So take a look at the English translation of that book. It is really, really beautiful. The hand of God removed you from her and brought you into this world. Then she was most happy, feeding you, forgetting her own hunger, clothing you even if she herself had no clothes, giving you milk and water, not caring for her own thirst, keeping you in the shade, even if she had to suffer from the heat of the sun, giving you every comfort with her own hardships, lulling you to sleep while keeping herself awake. The beautiful lullabies of the mothers when you were a child.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from Series of Today's Special from Arab English Radio. This is Ali, your host, with another topic to discuss with you on motherhood. A good mother has outstanding qualities. No one can replace her in life of her children. Here we can mention some of the things which can make her so unique. The first is a deep love for her children. A mother's love is unmatched, whether young or old, healthy or handicapped, troublesome or obedient. The child is still beloved to the mother. This love may be displayed in various forms. Sometimes children misinterpret scoldings and rebukes to be a sign of lack of love. It is important to assure the child that he is always loved, even when his behavior warrants disciplinary measures. Such a child becomes confident and happy and will never seek solace elsewhere. The love of the mother becomes a source of happiness and peace at home. Children feel attached to the home because of the mother. IRIB English Radio. Recitation as well as translation of Quran.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا مُوسَى الْكِتَابَ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَهْتَدُونَ.
And we certainly gave Moses the scripture that perhaps they would be guided.
Short commentary of the Quran.
Islamic issues.
The institution of the family in Islam is the most beloved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The life of the infallible. All in all, in today's special, IRIB English Radio.
Qualities of a mother. Model for the child. Many mothers think it's too great a burden to be acting near perfect all the time, even in the familiarity of their own homes. However, it is a good training. What mothers will change in themselves for the children will become a habit and will lead to a real change. It is not perfection that Islam demands from mothers, but a willingness to accept the responsibility of modeling good, acceptable behavior. This is an excuse young spouses today bring for having only one child. We want to go by perfection. No, nobody gonna be perfect. And one child does not make you as parents perfect, and your responsibilities will not be perfected toward one child. So one child policy is not a good policy. Many great people remember their mothers and the role they played in nurturing their greatness. Sayyid al-Radhi, the compiler of Nahjul Balagha, mourned the death of his mother greatly. He wrote a poem for her in which he says, "Oh mother, I cry and shed tears for your separation, hoping that perhaps the burning drops of tears coming out of my sorrowful eyes may melt and remove the mountain of sadness from my heart. Oh mother, all are witness that you were an honorable and noble lady because you have handed over decent and noble children to society." Tips for Muslim mother. Today's tip: try to calm yourself in case of disobedience. Children are immature. That's why they are called children. So don't expect every decent and mature behavior from them. Things may go wrong at times, but you can sort them out and correct them with patience. You may expect your child to obey your command, but he or she may disobey. Now here, you have to prove yourself a very kind and nice Muslim mother, having a sitting with them and tell them the pros and cons of their bad action. Be patient and keep yourself calm inside situations. Patience is the key to any type of problem.
The second point that can be mentioned as one of the other qualities of a mother is sacrifice and dedication. A mother gives up a great deal for the sake of the child. She gives up her time, her sleep, her pleasure, and etc. to ensure that the child is alright. As Imam Zain al-Abidin salamullah alayhi says in his book Risalatul Huquq, mentioned that have been mentioned earlier in the beginning of this very show, nobody comes even close to doing what a mother does for her child. That is why he says that it is only with help of the Almighty that one can thank the mother for all her sacrifice and efforts. A good mother places the needs of the child, both physical and emotional needs, first.
This is an important point to keep in mind, especially in these modern times. Women today are deluded by society into making their own careers and jobs more important than their homes. The home will always remain a woman's most valuable work, and that may require all types of sacrifice. It is not really a sacrifice, but is an investment which will reap great dividends.
Thank you very much for being with us with today's special about motherhood and about parenting. We hope you enjoyed today's episode with me, Atta, the host of this program. For more information, don't forget to visit our website, iranradio.ir. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Till another episode, we leave you Allah's care. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi. محمد نبي علي إمامي لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي إمامي لا إله إلا الله الله ربي محمد نبي علي إمامي لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي إمامي
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Storytellers who go beyond the boundaries of conventional filmmaking to capture the soul of reality, unveiling moments that are raw, unfiltered, and profoundly impactful. These filmmakers use their craft to explore the complexities of culture, history, and human emotion. My guest today is a documentary filmmaker who has dedicated his lens to capturing the untold stories of resilience, tradition, and transformation in a rapidly evolving world. He brings to light the perspectives and voices that might otherwise go unheard. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Nura, your host.
Zhang Zhong is a media personality whose creative work centers on three key pillars: preserving and promoting Chinese culture and traditions, such as Peking opera and other classical performances, exploring fundamental societal issues within China across diverse social layers, and fostering international collaborations, having worked with countries like North Korea, Iran, Japan, and France. His multifaceted approach reflects a deep commitment to cultural dialogue, social insight, and global exchange.
Mr. Zhang Zhong, it's a pleasure to have you on SORP.
I'm very happy to be your guest on this program.
Thank you. What first inspired you to pursue filmmaking and why documentary as your chosen game?
I was born in Western China. Actually, that's where I'm originally from. My neighbors were Muslim too. I moved to Beijing to study. Once I started school, I kept wondering what major I should choose. Eventually, I decided to study directing. I earned my bachelor's degree in directing, then went on to get a master's in cinema and a PhD in communications. After graduating, I worked in the technical field for quite a long time. Things like 3D technology and some 3D imaging techniques and similar areas. I wasn't doing any directing back then. It was about 10 years after graduation that I finally started working in directing.
Can you tell us about the first documentary you ever made?
Back when I was still studying, the first documentary I made was about Muslims, and it focused on one of the regions in Western China. In that area, the locals baked a kind of traditional bread. Actually, it's quite similar to the kind you find in Iran. Some of them also crafted small knives by hand. Using visuals and filming, I created a documentary about them. So, my first documentary told the story of two people, one who made knives and the other who baked traditional bread.
I want
to know the role of your childhood and your upbringing in the vision and the style you chose for yourself as a filmmaker.
I think we all know that the source of creating any artistic work is real life. Everything comes from lived experiences. The films I make now, including documentaries, are all about the events and people around me. As we grow as individuals, we go through different phases: childhood, adolescence, youth, and middle age. And along the way, our feelings about life evolve. At the same time, we humans are constantly learning and progressing within society. These processes are exactly what we need to draw from life and express through visuals. Through imagery, we show the audience what the film is reflecting, its theme and ideas. I believe many films, especially documentaries, capture and mirror life. That's what a film is for a director. It's like their lens. I see it as a way for a director to document real life.
And what themes do you most pick for your documentaries?
My work mainly focuses on three areas. First, Chinese culture and traditions, things like Peking opera and other traditional Chinese performances. Second, I pay attention to fundamental issues within China, meaning topics related to different layers of society and their core content. Third, I focus on international collaborations. In the beginning, I worked with North Korea and Iran, and now I collaborate with Japan, France, and other countries. Overall, my creativity and body of work revolve around these three pillars.
And which films of yours do you think represents your artistic style the best way?
Well, of course, it's related to the film Chang'an Chang'an, which I made 3 years ago in collaboration with Iran. I really love this film, and I believe that both in terms of cinematography and production, as well as its concept and artistic vision, it stands as a successful international work. So, yes, I'm very proud of it.
I'm going to talk a little bit about censorship and challenges. Have you ever faced censorship in your work and in your career?
I think every country has its own rules, guidelines, and management style When it comes to filmmaking, China is no different. Actually, the whole world is like that. But personally, I feel that filming and making movies in China is quite free, especially for someone like me, who may not know many people but can still go out and shoot. It feels very open. I can choose the topics I'm interested in, and I don't really face any major obstacles.
And I want to ask you a question regarding, you talked about a co-production with Iran, with Nargis Abya, a very famous filmmaker. How was that experience, and how did you come up with the idea?
I have deep admiration for Iranian filmmakers, the directors, writers, behind-the-scenes crew, and their teams. They manage to create truly remarkable films within a very limited environment and under a fairly strict regulatory system. Iranian films, whether feature films, documentaries, or TV series, often receive numerous awards on the international stage. So I've learned a lot from them, especially through my collaboration with director Nargis Abyar on this film. In this project, she was the writer, producer, assistant director, and also the production manager on the Iranian side. I completed the filming in China, and then we worked on editing, sound design, color correction, and final production in Iran. The Iranian crew worked with incredible precision and attention to detail, and their dedication and persistence in the art had a profound impact on my own creativity. The film is currently being screened, and so far we've participated in over 30 international festivals and received several awards.
Well, in a conversation that we had before, you said that the name of the film, the title of the film, was the name of a very little town in China. What was the story about that, and how could you find common grounds with an Iranian culture in order to make that film with Nargis Abya?
We all know that China and Iran are civilizations with deep ancient roots, nearly 2,000 years of history. Back then, we had discussions about why we should name the film Chang'an, Chang'an. The name Chang'an refers to one of China's most prosperous cities during the Tang Dynasty, which is why it was chosen. At that time, Chang'an referred to the historical city from the Tang era, which today is known as Xi'an, the same historic Chang'an. Silk and Chinese porcelain were brought into Iran via the Silk Road, and in return, Persian carpets, rugs, pomegranates, and agricultural products were sent to China along that same route. So, from ancient times, China and Iran have had ongoing cultural and economic exchanges. We blended East and West, combining the historical Chang'an of China with modern-day Xi'an, and that's how the name came to be. Initially, director Ms. Nargis Abyar named the film Chang'an, and her intention was to highlight the Silk Road, the path that connected China and Iran, flowing both ways, from China to Iran and from Iran to China.
Right, and my final question regarding that film is that, has it ever been publicly screened in China? I want to know the reaction of a Chinese audience to that film.
The film premiered in China and included expert panels and special screenings designed to gather different perspectives. It was well received by the Chinese government, local media, and audiences alike. There was also a special screening in Xi'an as part of the Silk Road Film Festival, where around 1,500 young people watched the film. They gave us a warm applause and shared really positive feedback.
Getting back to the creative process of making a documentary or even a feature film, as is your specialty, how do you approach research and storytelling for your projects?
We all know that working on a project is no easy task. From the moment an idea forms in your mind and you begin to shape it, then turn it into a script, move on to filming, and finally complete it. It's a lot like giving birth to a child. Every stage of the process involves both thought and action, each with its own rhythm. In this journey, you start from nothing and gradually, step by step, you build it. It's almost like creating a human being. At first, there's nothing, but slowly it grows and transforms into a complete work of art.
I see. Can you describe the collaborative process with your team during production? Because, of course, cinema and filmmaking is a teamwork. Even a small documentary, you need a really, really well-coordinated team with you. How do you do that? How do you manage the team?
No film, whether it's a documentary, a feature, or a television production, can be made by just one person, especially in China. When I'm making a film, I never list myself as a sole director, even when preparing subtitles. That's because creating a film is never a one-person job. It takes a strong team to bring a project to completion, just like this interview. There are many people working behind the scenes, even though the audience only sees the two of us. That's why teamwork is so important. Over the course of my 20-year career, we've assembled many different teams to create various films, and every single one has required collective effort, not just the work of one individual.
And, of course, what techniques do you use to ensure the authenticity and connection with your subjects? How do you stay true to the subject that you pick to work with?
When I make a film, there are often many celebrities involved, but there's also another group, just normal people, especially when it comes to documentaries. We have to make sure the footage feels genuine and authentic. To do that, we use different techniques. Sometimes we rely on discrete filming to capture real moments in people's lives. It's also important to treat the subjects of the film like family, with warmth and respect, so they forget the camera is even there. That way, they stop noticing the lights and microphones and just act naturally. This helps us capture raw, first-hand footage. Moments so real that even the subjects themselves might forget they're being filmed. Many of these scenes truly document real life.
Regarding that, we have, of course, you know, different schools of documentary filmmaking. There is a school who believes that a documentary maker must act like a fly on the wall and just witness and record everything as they are, as they happen in the moment. But there is also another school of thought in documentary making that says that you need to be proactive with your subject. You need to be always even meddle with the story of the subject for the better. Try to like help them find ways to better their situations and everything. I want to know which school exactly you belong with.
I enjoy both styles, but personally, I lean more towards capturing reality. I believe we shouldn't interfere with the lives of the people we're filming. That's why this kind of footage feels more authentic and genuine. During this film festival, I've watched many short films and documentaries, I think the most powerful images are the ones that are real. As directors, we have to decide how much we want to intervene in our subjects' lives or guide their path. Because in the end, we are creating a work of art. That's why I agree with the idea that non-fiction documentaries, especially those that don't use professional actors and instead portray ordinary people, sometimes require a bit of directorial intervention to make the final piece more impactful and relatable. That kind of involvement plays a very important role in shaping the final work.
Mr. Zhang Zhang, once again, thank you so much for taking the time and coming to SOAP. And thank you guys for staying with us on another conversation. This is SOAP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Batman.
You may cut off my breath, but never my faith, no, never my faith, it's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice. You may cut off my breath, but never my faith. It's my voice. You may chain both my hands, but never my soul, never my soul, it's my voice. It's your choice. A hurricane of shouts is shaking. Your house is shaking. Your house, it's my voice. When you fight against love, there's no way to survive. There's no way to survive. It's your choice. My soul, no, never my soul, it's my voice.